Hello, this is Lori, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Thursday, October 2nd issue of the Canandaigua Daily Messenger on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Teachers paying out of pocket for supplies. Shanna Danielson, a music teacher at Bermudian Springs Middle School near Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, admits that she spent a stupid amount of her own money on artificial plants to transform her cinder block walled classroom into a cozy jungle. Her son donated many of the stuffed animals that peek through the leaves at practicing students. She also loves buying props that add pizzazz to band performances, including a penguin cutout that stood on stage as students performed Penguin Promenade during the 2024-25 school year. I'm ashamed to admit I spent like $50, she said, but you should have seen the joy on their faces. Teachers like Danielson can spend hundreds of dollars out of pocket trying to make learning fun for students. Other teachers might spend just as much on necessary school supplies like pencils and books, especially at low-income schools where resources are sparse and families can't afford to buy their own materials. Some teachers buy snacks for their classrooms too, knowing kids need fuel to focus. Not only are teachers expected to fill in those gaps where students can't get their own school supplies, so we're buying pencils and notebooks and pens, we're also constantly replacing these items, because things get lost or things get broken, said Adriana Ocañas, consumer credit cards analyst at U.S. News and World Report. Ocaña spent 3 years as a teacher before switching careers. During the 2024-25 school year, teachers spent, on average, $884 of their own money, $3.35 billion in total, on cleaning supplies, prizes, snacks, decorations, books, pens, paper, hand sanitizer, and more, according to My eLearning World. Her survey from Adopt a Classroom found teachers on average spent $895 out of pocket on school supplies, a 49% increase since 2015. Teachers told the USA Today network the amount they spend varies. Some educators rely on local grants, donations, and online wish lists through Amazon, Adopt a Classroom, Donors Choose, and other platforms to stock their classrooms. One teacher near Seattle promotes other teachers' wish lists online, and Emmy Award-winning actress Kristen Bell noticed. Bell cleared some of the teachers' wish lists on Sarah Stair's website last year and recently gifted Stair $25,000 to help clear teachers' wish list ahead of the 2025-26 school year. Every year, most teachers use their own paychecks to make sure schools are a happy and safe place for our kids, Bell wrote in an August 15th Instagram post. Please consider donating if you can, and let's show up for our educators. I was shocked, Stair said about getting Bell's attention for the first time. I thought it was fake at first. Stair enjoys helping fellow teachers with school supplies, but she said there are many other issues in education that put a strain on teachers. I can't necessarily make a huge systemic change overnight happen, but hopefully I can bring awareness to people who don't realize how much teachers are having to invest, Stair said. America needs to do better in funding schools and paying teachers what they deserve, said Princess Moss, vice president of the National Education Association. In 2023-24, the national average public school teacher salary rose by 3.8% to $72,030, according to the association's most recent Educator Pay in America report. But average teacher pay hasn't kept up with inflation, the report found, and nearly 17% of American school districts offer starting salaries of less than $40,000. Teachers are going to do what they need to do to ensure that their students have what they need in order to survive and to thrive, Moss said. Danielson said she spends roughly $400 to $600 each year on students. Though her district gives her a small annual budget for beefing up her classroom instrument inventory, the funds are for approved vendors that mostly sell new instruments. She can't use this money to snap up a cheap find from eBay, and it doesn't stretch as far as she would like. So, sometimes she dips into her personal money when she stumbles across a good quality flute on Facebook Marketplace or a trombone at a garage sale. It's very frustrating, she said. I don't feel like money should ever keep somebody from loving or learning music. Teachers are feeling squeezed, said American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten. They need more resources to help make their classrooms the safe and welcoming places that students need to learn, Weingarten said. What other professionals are asked to fund their work like teachers? A Coachella Valley High School in Thermal, California, history teacher Perla Penalber estimates her yearly out-of-pocket spending at $1,800 for classroom basics, club expenses, and items to make her room more welcoming. She doesn't ask families for contributions or post online wish lists, since many of her students come from migrant families working in agriculture and often face financial hardship. Budget cuts and inflation only add to the challenge. But it's worth it, Penalber said, especially when she sees even reluctant learners motivated by the activities she's able to provide. It's not about how much you're getting out of it, Penalber said. It's more about what you're giving back that's going to continue to give to the future. And hopefully, they'll take that with them. Teachers aren't the only school employees spending their own money to help students. Lakeisha Bear Myers, a social worker at a central Pennsylvania school district, said she's become an expert coupon clipper and bargain hunter as she stocks up on food and clothes for students. Bear Myers, who worked at Reynolds Middle School in Lancaster since 2017, said she purchases school supplies in bulk at Staples during store clearances, and once grabbed 40 sweatshirts from Kohl's because they were on a steep markdown. These finds are stored in a small office that she calls the Care Closet, where students can browse for toiletries, socks, underwear, food, shoes, and other items they and their families might need. She said 40 to 50 students come to her each day for breakfast, lunch, or snacks. Bear Myers relied on her own money, about $300 per month, with coupons when she was feeding 10 kids per day. But in recent years, her community's needs have dramatically increased. Now she said she gets help from community organizations that contribute food and monetary donations. It causes a great amount of stress and uneasiness because teachers are facing the same financial hurdles that our students' families are feeling, Bear Myers said. Tariffs could impact school supplies this school year, Okanyas said, especially on items like backpacks, laptops, clothes, shoes, pencils, and pens. 8 in 10 teachers in the Adopt a Classroom survey said inflation and rising costs of school supplies were a concern. And a recent U.S. News & World Report survey found parents might not be as willing to help teachers out because of rising costs. The share of Americans planning to spend $101 to $300 per child when shopping for back-to-school items dropped from 52% last year to 41% this year, survey data shows. More than one-third of caregivers said they'd donate $20 or less to their kids' classroom for supplies this school year. Still, Okanyas suggests teachers reach out to their community for help if they need it. Given the opportunity, the Covington, Kentucky community came out in full force to support their teachers during a school supply event in August. The Kenton County Public Library branch in Covington found a surplus of gently used supplies while reconstructing the building. Then community members donated other new and used items to the cause. Dagmar Morales, the branch's programming coordinator, said 85 teachers and homeschool families picked up supplies during the event. Morales estimates the supplies added up to about $10,000. Teachers told her they felt overwhelmed by the support, she said. She hopes a library can pull off the event again next year. It was an event that brought the community together, Morales said. Trump-Pfizer announced deal on some drug prices. President Donald Trump announced a deal with Pfizer for the drug maker to voluntarily sell medications through Medicaid at lower prices as his administration pushes to bring down drug prices in the United States to match other countries. A White House also said it plans to unveil a new website, dubbed TrumpRx, to allow direct-to-consumers sales of drugs. Trump, in a September 30th announcement from the Oval Office, said all new Pfizer medications introduced to the U.S. market will be sold at prices that are no greater than those of comparable countries. The agreement follows an executive order Trump signed in March that instituted a most favored nation policy for drug pricing. We'll be paying essentially what other countries are paying, Trump said, adding that he's working with other major pharmaceutical companies to reach similar agreements. Pfizer is prepared to invest $70 billion in U.S. manufacturing and research over the coming years. In exchange, the Trump administration agreed to a 3-year grace period in which Pfizer will not be subject to tariffs on pharmaceutical products. The TrumpRx website is expected to be operating by early 2026, according to a senior Trump administration official. A statement from Pfizer said the domain will be TrumpRx.gov. Consumers will be able to type in the name of a drug they want to purchase at the website, which will then redirect them to a site where they can buy the drug from the manufacturer, the official said. The official added that negotiations could drive drug prices lower for Medicaid, the federal state public health insurance program. Trump has long argued the United States is getting ripped off by paying higher drug prices than many nations despite leading the world in medical innovation. He said his administration plans to launch an investigation on unfair and discriminatory trade practices of other countries, he said, shift the cost burden of pharmaceutical drugs to Americans. Drug prices in the United States are nearly 3 times higher than 33 comparison countries, according to a 2024 report from the Department of Health and Human Services. The White House said Americans will begin to see lower prices on prescription drugs purchased through Medicaid in early 2026. Officials project the cost of Eucrisa to treat dermatitis is expected to drop by 80%, Duavi to treat postmenopausal osteoporosis by 85%, Zevsprit for migraines by 50%, and Xeljanz to treat rheumatoid arthritis by 40%. Today we are turning the tide and we are reversing an unfair situation, Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla said. Bourla said Trump's looming tariffs on drug imports motivated Pfizer to secure the agreement with the Trump administration. The previous week, Trump announced a new round of tariffs beginning in October and imposing a 100% duty on brand name drugs imported to the United States. Drug companies have no limits when setting prices for brand name drugs, but the amount consumers pay depends on negotiations hashed out with insurers and pharmacy benefit managers. Insurance plan requirements such as co-pays and deductibles also affect how much people will pay. Donald Trump, Pete Hegseth addressed military wrath. President Donald Trump threatened to fire top military leaders who might disagree with him September 30th as his war secretary, formerly defense secretary, accused the Pentagon of suffering from weakness and woke decay. Trump praised the generals as incredible people, straight out of central casting, but more notably, he told a packed meeting of top military commanders in Quantico, Virginia, "If you don't like what I'm saying, you can leave the room. Of course, there goes your rank, there goes your future, but you just feel nice and loose, okay?" With Trump as his backstop, Secretary of War Pete Hegseth told the country's military elite they had gone soft and that reforms would weed out political correctness from the world's most powerful armed forces. He decried fat generals and admirals. Echoing Trump's threats, the former Fox News host said, "If the words I'm speaking today are making your heart sink, you should do the honorable thing and resign." The secretary announced 10 new directives, including tougher physical fitness testing, ordering troops to shave their beards and cut their hair short, and requiring service members to meet height and weight standards. "We're not talking hot yoga and stretching," Hegseth said. He labeled troops who have medical or religious exemptions to grow beards as beardos. An implementation memo specified that troops can no longer receive permanent shaving waivers that prevent painful skin conditions. According to Pentagon policy memos, fitness tests will increase in frequency and intensity for active duty troops, who must now pass twice yearly tests. Military members will also have their body fat measured twice per year. Troops with combat-focused jobs, such as infantrymen or tank crew members, must meet male standards in their annual general fitness test, and they must complete a combat field test annually. Hegseth said the move is not about preventing women from serving. Hegseth's remarks dovetailed with his long-held views, the subject of his 2024 book, The War on Warriors, that diversity initiatives, political correctness, and a perceived lowering of standards on the behalf of women has made the military weaker. At the Quantico meeting, he said those convictions led him to fire a number of top officers, an apparent allusion to the abrupt retirements of Joint Chiefs Chair Air Force General C.Q. Brown, former Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Lisa Franchetti, Army General Timothy Ha of U.S. Cyber Command and the National Security Agency, and the top lawyers of the Army and Air Force, among others. The addresses came as Trump has ordered U.S. troops into a growing number of cities to support deportations and suppress crime. The president spoke for 72 minutes, saying dangerous cities should be used as military training grounds, and speaking of his plans to take on the enemy within using military power. "Last month, I signed an executive order to provide training for a quick reaction force that can help quell civil disturbances," he said. "It's the enemy from within, and we have to handle it before it gets out of control." Trump said it was his idea to change the Defense Department's name back to the War Department, a name it carried through World War II. "The 20th century name change was probably the first sign of wokeness," he said. At one point, he made a reference to a racial slur, noting that he sent nuclear submarines over to the coast of Russia in response to provocative comments by a Russian spokesperson referencing a nuclear control system. "We can't let people throw around that word," he told his mostly stone-faced audience. "I'll call it the N-word. There are two N-words, and you can't use either of them." The president's attacks on former President Joe Biden were met with silence, as per a Poole report. It was a rare and mandatory gathering of hundreds of top generals and admirals called with just a week's notice. The Pentagon did not provide an attendee list, but a camera pan appeared to show two of the military's most far-flung brass, Army General Xavier Brunson, who leads U.S. and United Nations forces in South Korea, and Navy Admiral Samuel Papero, who heads the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command from Hawaii. Other top generals on the official video feed included U.S. Northern Command leader Air Force General Gregory Gio, who oversees the military's work along the Mexican border and its immigration enforcement support; Army General Brian Fenton, who heads U.S. Special Operations Command; and Air Force General Anthony Cotton, who oversees the nation's nuclear arsenal atop U.S. Strategic Command. Responding on MSNBC, retired Lieutenant General Mark Hertling said Trump's speech was somewhat shocking and filled with mistruths. Hertling, the former commander of Army forces in Europe, said, "I found my mouth open. I just couldn't believe some of the things that were being said to this group of individuals who have such experience. I find it really offensive that anyone is insulting them and claiming that their promotions and their advancement through the services are a result of policies or wokeness or DEI, Hertling continued. It's just not true. Representative Gregory Meeks, Democrat New York, the ranking Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, blasted Trump and Hegseth for what he called empty posturing that failed to address the country's national security challenges. He called for Hegseth to resign over his overall lack of professionalism and experience. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Canandaigua Daily Messenger on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. New Bills-themed ice cream available at Wegmans. The Buffalo Bills and Wegmans are collaborating ahead of the team's rivalries game against the New England Patriots on October 5th to bring fans some exclusive items. A limited edition Bring the Storm ice cream is available now in Wegmans stores in Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, New York Southern Tier, and Erie, Pennsylvania, while supplies last. The specialty ice cream is blue, cake-flavored ice cream with vanilla cake pieces and white sprinkles, according to Wegmans. Shoppers can try the limited edition ice cream in stores on October 4th and 5th. A Bills sweepstakes for a Rivalries prize pack consisting of exclusive Bills Rivalries products and a Wegmans gift card is also taking place. One winner will be picked each month for 3 months or while supplies last. To find out more, scan the QR code in stores or visit buffalobills.com. Ontario County Fire Police Officers Complete Training. The Ontario County Fire Police Class of 2025 on September 28th successfully completed a three-week training course, culminating in a real-world practical exercise at the annual Naples Grape Festival. Ontario County Sheriff's Office Lieutenant Chris Drake and Sergeant Peyton Francher led the course, which was held Tuesday and Thursday evenings at the Ontario County Safety Training Facility. This year's class included 17 participants, ranging from first-time trainees to seasoned fire police officers with over 20 years of experience. Attendees came from the following fire departments: Victor, Richmond, Hall, Manchester, Branchport, Westlake Road, Crystal Beach, White Springs, Hopewell, Ithaca, Livonia, and Farmington. The final practical exercise placed trainees directly into the field, managing both vehicle and pedestrian traffic for 3 hours during the Naples Grape Festival. The Ontario County Fire Police Training Program equips volunteers and professionals alike with the skills needed to manage emergency scenes and public events safely and effectively. This training program is offered on an annual basis. Bloomfield Lions to hold a spaghetti dinner. The Bloomfield Lions Club will be holding a spaghetti dinner from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. October 8th, or until sold out, at the Veterans Club, 6910 State Routes 5 and 20. The cost is $12, $6 for ages 12 and under. Proceeds benefit the club's charitable works. The Bloomfield girls volleyball team will be assisting in the dining room. The menu includes spaghetti, meatballs, bread, salad, and ice cream. The next dinner is November 12th. Registration begins for ARC Ontario's Canandaigua Turkey Trot. Runners can begin to gear up for Thanksgiving now. The ARC Ontario's 16th annual Canandaigua Turkey Trot 5K Fun Run and Walk will take place on Thanksgiving morning, November 27th, at Frank A. Baker Memorial Park in Canandaigua. The event will officially begin at 9 a.m. All proceeds from the fundraiser will benefit the Friends of the ARC Ontario Foundation and its menu of innovative programs and services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities or other challenges. Participants can take advantage of the early bird rate of $20 by pre-registering online at www.thearcontario.org/turkey-trot before the deadline of 11:59 p.m. November 26th. Day of the registration will be $25 and online registration will remain available until 9 a.m. November 27th. Children 12 and under can register for free. For attendees who prefer to register in person on the day of the event, registration will start at 7:45 a.m. The Bloomfield Garden Club to hear talk on African violets. The Bloomfield Garden Club will induct officers and listen to a presentation on African violets at its next meeting. The club will gather at 11:30 a.m. October 16th at Veterans Park, 6910 State Routes 5 and 20. Cornell Cooperative Extension of Ontario County Master Gardener Susie Nettleton will be the presenter. Refreshments will be provided. Social Security paper checks to phase out. As of September 30th, New Yorkers and others across the country are no longer able to receive a paper Social Security check in the mail. The Social Security Administration announced earlier this year they're going to paperless because electronic fund transfers process more quickly, cost less, and are a safer way to receive your benefits than paper checks. President Donald Trump issued an executive order in March declaring federal benefit payments to primarily be issued electronically, which has led to paper checks being phased out in many cases. This change is part of a broader government-wide initiative to modernize payment systems and enhance service delivery, the SSA said. By moving to electronic payments exclusively, we aim to improve efficiency, security, and ensure beneficiaries receive their monthly benefits promptly. According to the SSA, the change will only affect a small group of beneficiaries who haven't switched to electronic payment methods yet. Here's how to sign up for the two electronic options. Direct deposit. Beneficiaries can use or sign up for a Social Security online account at www.ssa.gov/myaccount to manage direct deposit information and access benefit details. Supplemental security income recipients and international beneficiaries can call 1-800-772-1213 for assistance. A second method is the Direct Express card, a safe and convenient prepaid debit card option for those without a bank account. To enroll, call 1-800-333-1795 or visit www.usdirectexpress.com. Beneficiaries interested in requesting an exemption from the electronic payment requirement, which the SSA says are approved in extremely rare circumstances, must file a waiver with the U.S. Treasury by calling 1-877-874-6347. SSA technicians are available to assist beneficiaries with this transition and to answer any questions. Multiple tort claims filed against ICE. Rebecca Shuhead watched the surveillance video in horror. One immigration agent knocked her father, a 79-year-old U.S. citizen, to the ground inside his car wash business. When he got back up and went outside, two others tackled him to the pavement. An agent could be seen barreling into her father, Rafi Ola Shohed, she said, bulldozing down the hallways like a linebacker. Under President Donald Trump's nationwide immigration crackdown, federal agents are on orders to aggressively go after people they believe are in the country illegally. The increasingly violent arrest encounters have resulted in multiple multi-million dollar tort claims by people, including U.S. citizens, who say they were severely harmed or wrongfully detained during immigration and customs enforcement operations. Department of Homeland Security leaders have accused alleged use of force victims of a resisting arrest, assaulting agents, or impeding law enforcement operations. If you lay a hand on our law enforcement, we will prosecute you to the fullest extent of the law, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said in a September 19th post on X. Shohed, the owner of Valley Car Wash in Van Nuys, California, filed a $50 million tort claim September 26th against the Department of Homeland Security and its component agencies, including ICE, claiming agents illegally and unlawfully assaulted and battered him during their operation. A Homeland Security spokesperson said in an emailed statement to USA Today that agents arrested five illegal aliens from Guatemala and Mexico who broke our nation's immigration laws, and that Shohed impeded the operation and was arrested for assaulting and impeding a federal officer. ICE detained Shohed for nearly 12 hours. According to the tort claim, he was not charged with a crime. James DeSimon, the attorney representing Shohed in his claim, said the car wash owner told agents to let him show his employees' work authorization paperwork. DeSimon said surveillance video clearly shows Shohed isn't engaging in threatening conduct. Instead of talking to him, they just immediately resort to force, and force that was very brutal, DeSimon said. Shohed said in a news conference after the September 9th incident that agents only repeated, "You do not," expletive with the ICE. Rebecca Shohed said she went crazy after seeing the video. Her father has had a heart attack. He has three stents in his heart. It appears to be the pattern of these agents to resort to force at any time when they are questioned or confronted, DeSimon said. A 2018 policy memo written and distributed during the first Trump administration provided detailed guidance on when and how Homeland Security law enforcement officers may use force. They may use force to control subjects in the course of their official duties as authorized by law and in defense of themselves and others. To meet the standards of the Fourth Amendment, the Homeland Security guidelines require use of force to be objectively reasonable in a given situation. The guidelines also recognize that law enforcement officers are often forced to make split-second judgments in circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving. Use of physical force must stop when resistance ceases or when the incident is under control. Rafi Ola Shuhed's tort claim isn't the first against Homeland Security this year. In another, in August, the wife and daughter of a farm worker who died following an ICE raid on a California cannabis greenhouse claim, ICE agents clad in battle gear used excessive force that resulted in the fatal fall that killed Jamie Alanis, 56. Alanis died of blunt force head and neck injuries 2 days after the raid, according to family and the Ventura County Medical Examiner's Office. His widow and daughter are each seeking $47 million. Separately in August, U.S. citizen and Iraq War veteran George Reetes filed a tort claim against Homeland Security seeking unspecified damages after ICE agents allegedly broke his car window and arrested him at an ICE roadblock in Southern California, then held him for 3 days without access to an attorney. All three claims were filed under the Federal Tort Claims Act, which can precede a lawsuit in federal court. The act was created to allow people to sue the federal government when they are harmed by government employees, according to the Institute for Justice, a nonprofit law firm representing Reetes in his claim. The legislation requires plaintiffs, before suing in court, to first submit claims to the responsible federal agencies. In its fiscal year 2025 budget report, ICE said its litigation division was defending, as of fiscal 2023, more than 350 administrative tort claims seeking over $55.5 billion in damages. The agency has paid out just $813,565 in complete claims, according to the report. There have been few public consequences this year for ICE and other federal agents captured on video manhandling immigrants, protesters, or bystanders. But an unnamed ICE agent was relieved of current duties in September after video circulated showing him slamming a distraught woman to the floor inside an immigration court building in New York City. Rebecca Shuhead said she is concerned for what's to come as Trump's crackdown widens. Nobody is able to rein this in, she said. It's like a free-for-all. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Canandaigua Daily Messenger on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Guard asked to deploy to Chicago. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker told reporters on September 29th that he just learned that the Department of Homeland Security requested the National Guard deploy to the region despite vociferous objectives from the area's leaders. "What I have been warning of is now being realized," Pritzker said at a news conference. "This is not about fighting crime. This is about sowing fear and intimidation among Americans. This is about consolidating power in Donald Trump's hands." The governor said the DHS sent a memo to the Department of War, formerly the Department of Defense, requesting 100 troops from the Illinois National Guard. The troops, Pritzker said, are to be used to support immigration and customs enforcement agents carrying out the president's Chicago area immigration enforcement crackdown, known as Operation Midway Blitz. Chief Pentagon spokesperson Sean Parnell confirmed that the Department of War had received a request for troops. Parnell did not say if the National Guard would be deployed. The Department of War has received a request for assistance to safeguard federal personnel, property, and functions in the state of Illinois, Parnell said. Any decisions will be made in accordance with established processes and announced at the appropriate time. Trump has been saying since early September that he planned to send the National Guard to Chicago, but the White House has not deployed troops over the objections of the area's leaders. Illinois officials fear that Trump is using clashes between federal agents and anti-immigration enforcement protesters as justification to deploy soldiers. The president said the operation is aimed at catching the worst of the worst criminals who are immigrants. Illinois leaders have said the Republican president's goal is to take control of the heavily Democratic region. Illinois officials did not say when exactly National Guard members would deploy. Pritzker said the memo from Homeland Security to the War Department was the same avenue taken to deploy troops to Portland, Oregon. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul said he was prepared to file a lawsuit against the White House if troops did deploy. In addition to Pritzker and Raoul, the September 29th news conference included Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, Cook County President Tony Preckwinkle, and Broadview Mayor Katrina Thompson, whose village outside Chicago has become a hotbed of immigration enforcement and protest. The expected National Guard deployment comes about 3 weeks into the launch of Operation Midway Blitz. DHS officials said more than 700 immigrants have been detained in connection with the operation. The federal immigration enforcement crackdown reflects a significant change of pace for the longtime sanctuary city of Chicago and surrounding areas. Research compiled by the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, a research group that tracks immigration enforcement data, shows that over 6,000 people being detained have gone through the region's ICE facility in Broadview. The crackdown has sparked nearly around-the-clock protests at the facility. DHS officials have called protesters rioters, arrested multiple people, and charged at least two protesters with assault. Authorities say they brought handguns to the demonstration. Federal agents have used chemical agents, including pepper spray and tear gas, to disperse Chicago protesters blocking immigration enforcement vehicles. Agents on September 26 also fired chemical agents at protesters and journalists standing in a road leading up to the immigration enforcement facility in Broadview. What we're seeing is our First Amendment rights being eroded by an authoritarian administration determined to diminish dissent, State Senator Karina Villa told reporters on September 29th. The Illinois State Senator's heavily Latino district has seen significant immigration enforcement activity. Broadview officials said the Village Police Department is investigating federal agents for firing crowd control weapons at a news reporter's vehicle. DHS officials did not respond to repeated requests for comment on the investigation. DHS officials have said the Midway Blitz is necessary to catch criminal immigrants, and among the high-profile arrests they tout are people whose criminal history, according to immigration authorities, includes sexual abuse of a child, domestic violence, and battery. But people from the Chicago area say innocent people are being targeted simply based on the color of their skin. If you look like me, you are in danger, said Adriera Rendon, a native of Mexico who is a prominent immigrant advocate in Chicago. Rendon broke down in tears on September 29th as she read aloud a list of names of people taken by immigration agents. DHS terrorizes our communities and showcases our pain on social media. Research data from the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank, shows that in fiscal year 2025, 65% of immigration detainees have no criminal convictions and 93% have no violent convictions. Among people Chicagoans hold up as examples of innocent people detained are Laura Murillo, a popular Southside tamale vendor who was detained on September 25th, and Silverio Villas Gonzalez, a Mexican immigrant who was fatally shot by an immigration agent on September 12th after dropping his sons off at school, according to supporters. They're not targeting violent criminals or gang members, Pritzker said. They're targeting tamale vendors. Hamas reviewing Gaza peace plan. President Donald Trump on September 30th gave Hamas 3 to 4 days to accept a United States-backed peace plan for the Gaza Strip, warning of a very sad end if the group rejected the proposal that he said was close to ending the 2-year conflict. Mediators Qatar and Egypt shared the 20-point plan with Hamas late on September 29th after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had appeared alongside Trump at the White House and endorsed the document, saying it satisfied Israel's war aims. Hamas was not involved in the negotiations that led to the proposal, which calls on the Islamist militant group to disarm, a demand it has previously rejected. However, an official briefed on the talks told Reuters that the group would review it in good faith and provide a response. Speaking to reporters in Washington, Trump said Israeli and Arab leaders had already endorsed the plan and that we're just waiting for Hamas to make its decision. He gave the group 3 or 4 days to respond. Hamas is either going to be doing it or not, and if it's not, it's going to be a very sad end, Trump said as he left the White House. Asked whether there was scope for further talks on the proposal, he replied, not much. The plan specifies an immediate ceasefire and exchange of all hostages held by Hamas for Palestinian prisoners held by Israel, a staged Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, the disarmament of Hamas, and the introduction of a transitional government led by an international body. A source close to Hamas told Reuters the plan was completely biased to Israel and imposed impossible conditions that aimed to eliminate the group. Many elements of the 20 points have been included in numerous ceasefire deals proposed over the past 2 years, including those accepted and then subsequently rejected at various stages by both Israel and Hamas. One of Hamas's main conditions since the outset of the war has been a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza in return for the release of the remaining hostages. And while the group has indicated its readiness to relinquish administrative authority, it has consistently ruled out disarming. What Trump has proposed is the full adoption of all Israeli conditions, which do not grant the Palestinian people or the residents of the Gaza Strip any legitimate rights, a Palestinian official who asked not to be named told Reuters. However, Hamas faces considerable pressure to accept the plan, with the foreign ministers of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and Egypt all welcoming the initiative. Turkey's head of intelligence was set to join Qatari and Egyptian mediators in Doha to discuss the peace proposal on September 30th, a spokesperson for Qatar's foreign ministry said. Turkey has not previously been involved as a key mediator during efforts over the last 2 years to bring peace to Gaza. It was unclear if Hamas officials were to join the September 30th meeting. The last time Hamas leaders gathered to discuss a U.S. peace plan in Qatar, Israel tried and failed to kill them with a missile strike. Netanyahu apologized on September 29th to his Qatari counterpart for the September 9th attack, the White House said. Although he initially backed the Trump plan, Netanyahu later expressed doubts about elements of the proposal, including the prospects for eventual Palestinian statehood, something he has repeatedly ruled out. Netanyahu is under mounting pressure from a war-weary Israeli public to end the conflict, but he also risks the collapse of his governing coalition if far-right ministers believe he has made too many concessions for a peace deal. In Gaza itself, some Palestinians hailed Trump's peace plan, saying it could end the bombardment and deaths, but they wondered whether it would end Israel's control of the enclave. "We want the war to end, but we want the occupation army that killed tens of thousands of us to get out and leave us alone," said Salah Abu Amr, 60, a father of six from Gaza City, Gaza Strip. "We hope the plan will end the war, but we are not sure it will. Either Trump nor Netanyahu can be trusted," he told Reuters via a chat app. Israel began its Gaza offensive after the October 7, 2023 Hamas-led assault on Israel, in which some 1,200 people were killed and 251 taken as hostages. The offensive has killed over 66,000 people in Gaza, Gaza health authorities say. Israeli forces pushed deeper into Gaza City on September 30th, reaching the center of the territory, which Netanyahu has described as the last Hamas bastion. Israel also ramped up its bombardment of the residential districts, forcing some families to leave, witnesses and medics said. At least two people were killed when the Israeli army blew up an explosive-laden vehicle in Beach Camp in western Gaza City, medics said, while nine people, including a mother and five of her children, were killed in two separate attacks in Deir al-Bala and Khana Yunis in the south. Israeli planes also dropped new leaflets over the city ordering Palestinians to immediately leave and head south. "The battle against Hamas is decisive and will not end until it is defeated," the leaflet said in red writing. In sports, writer walks through stadium's last chapter. There's 4 hours until the 1 p.m. kickoff of the Buffalo Bills matchup against the New Orleans Saints on Sunday, and Sal Marinaro has to hit the ground running while walking. The 35-year veteran Bills reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle always arrives at Highmark Stadium hours before home games begin to beat the inevitable traffic jam. His first order of business? He has to get his steps in, and lots of them. He parks his car in a lot close to the stadium right around 9 a.m., pops an earbud in each ear, presses play on Oasis Familiar to Millions album, and starts the 45-minute, 2-mile walk around the outside perimeter of the stadium. Along his path, the first signs of tailgating are starting to appear. Lines of cars waiting to get into mostly empty parking lots are thickening. Those already inside are opening up their trunks, pulling out tents and folding tables and starting up their grills. This part of the almost four-decade beat reporter's pre-game routine started about a year and a half ago as a way to better his health, but it has morphed into a moment of tranquility before the intensity of the game. He's been in the car for almost 2 hours, too, so it doesn't hurt to stretch a bit before sitting for several more. You'd be hard-pressed to find someone who's taken more steps here than Maradona. He's been to over 400 games at what he still calls Rich Stadium, and although today's steps are far from his first inside high mark, he knows they are some of his last, each one carrying more weight. As the clock ticked closer to kickoff, the excitement in the stands grew. Fans began to fill the seats and cheered or booed emphatically as the teams took the field for warm-ups. Those in the lowest level tossed a ball around with a player or two. It's different inside the press box, though, the spot reserved for seasoned veterans like Maradona to watch the games. Tucked in the lower level of a tower jutting out of one corner of the stadium, the press box with its dark mirror-like windows and hushed chatter is a considerably different space than the general admission seats just beyond the box's 24 panes of floor-to-ceiling glass. The crowd is right there. When the team scores and people turn to each other to deliver high fives, press box reporters could reach over and join in it if it weren't for the glass, but the noise is almost completely muffled, like the stadium's roar is underwater. Stat sheets, pairs of binoculars, and plenty of caffeine are sprawled across four rows of long white granite tables. The room is evenly split. Those covering the Bills sit on the left, and the opposing team's coverage, today the New Orleans Saints, on the right. From the first row on the Bills' side, Maradona, squinting a bit, intently studies the field, briefly glances down at his laptop to jot down a few notes, and then returns his focus back outside. But once play starts, the conversations between the 50 or so reporters dim to a stark stillness. Two people occasionally break the silence in the top right corner of the room to call out each play, the second voice often repeating the stat with more detail through a microphone. There's no cheering in here for either team. It is not allowed. But an occasional dismissive wave of a hand or instinctual chuckle slips out after a play unfolds. It's a part of the job that might seem strange for the thousands of red, white, and blue clad fans stationed right outside the confines of the press box. But Maradona, who's been at this since the 90s, shed his fandom a long time ago. That focus is on the New York Yankees now. Maybe when I retire, maybe I'll become that teenager again, Maradona said. I'll be screaming at the TV if the Bills are playing bad, but not right now. But when Maradona first set foot in Highmark Stadium over 50 years ago, he was a fan like many other Buffalo native. It was the team's first game ever played in the then brand new stadium, a 37-21 preseason loss to Washington in 1973. Maradona's allegiance to the Bills came with the territory. He was born and raised mostly in Buffalo to parents who were born and raised there too. And even though he spent some time living in Syracuse growing up, he and his dad always bought tickets for the game closest to his October birthday. His sports writing career grew fast. He started as a stringer for the Associated Press while attending Buffalo State University in the 80s and worked his way up to being a full-time Bills beat reporter for the DNC in 1990, just 4 years into working for the paper. After a brief stint as a golf writer and a year covering Syracuse University football. Sports writing was his only career goal since a teacher he had in the sixth grade recognized his writing potential and helped him believe he could do it. "I knew I wanted to be a sports writer, just plain and simple," Maradona said. "There was nothing else I wanted to do." It's a job that's changed through the years. Today's media availability with the players can be frustrating, and journalists now write stories formatted for a chronically online audience, but he's adamant on not taking any of it for granted. I'm covering a team that I grew up a fan of, Marijuana said. Are you kidding me? It's the best job in the world. It wasn't quite the blowout some people were expecting on Sunday. The Bills topped the Saints 31-19 as head coach Sean McDermott picked up his 90th career win and safety Cole Bishop nabbed his first NFL interception. After the game clock reached zero, though, overtime began for Marijuana, meaning more steps. First, a mad dash to the tunnel to film a game recap video out on the field, then into the locker room to interview players like Bishop and linebacker Terrell Bernard before heading over to the press conference room where he, in classic Sal fashion, dropped a few choice words about how long it took for a post-game interview with McDermott to start. He eventually asked the head coach a couple of questions. He knew he had thrown out a good one when McDermott delivered a five-second non-answer. Back inside the press box, it's somehow even quieter than before. The workforce has been reduced to less than 20, and all you hear is the sound of fingers colliding with keyboards. There are still a few things left on Marijuana's to-do list before driving the hour and a half back to Rochester. Write up his observations from the game, hop on a YouTube live stream to share his thoughts on the game, and possibly fit in a podcast episode with former WGRZ sports director Adam Beningi. At the end of the night, Marijuana surprisingly fell short of his 18,000 daily steps goal, racking up around 9,000 in and around Highmark on Sunday. But every step here this season means a little more. In a matter of months, he'll take his last steps out of this stadium and his first into the new stadium just across the street. I will miss that place like I miss no place, Marijuana says about the last season inside the current Highmark Stadium. It's been my life. It's been my home away from home. Section 5 teams in New York State soccer ranking. Class C divisions show off depth. Midway through the fall season, Section 5's Class C divisions are showing off their depth. Nine total teams in that classification are ranked in the latest boys and girls soccer state rankings. In the girls list, Section 5 features three teams in the top five, Kendall, Byron Bergen, and Geneseo. The two Genesee region teams played last week as Kendall knocked off the defending state champions in a 2-1 match. Sophia Picardo had the match winning goal for the Eagles, while goalie Brooke Rodas made 12 saves. For the boys, Section 5 owns the top spot in four of the six classifications. Undefeated Naples joins Fairport AAA, Pittsford Mendon A, and Fillmore D among the top-ranked teams. The Big Green have three players with double-digit goals, Connor Vetras, 17, Ricardo Izzo, 12, and Maddox Manella, 10. Section 5 boys soccer teams in New York State rankings. The rankings reflect scores through Sunday, September 28th. Class AAA, number 1, Fairport. Class AA, number 7, Churchill Chilly, and number 13, Brockport. Class A, Pittsford Mendon is number 1. In Class B, number 4 is Hornell, number 9 is Minders, number 14 is Leroy Caledonia Mumford. Class C, number 1 is Naples, number 10 is Kendall, number 13 is Byron Bergen Elba, and number 16 is East Rochester. Now in Class D, number 1 is Fillmore, number 10 is North Star Christian. The Section 5 girls soccer team in New York State rankings, these reflect scores through Sunday, September 28th. In Class AAA, number 10 is Fairport. Class AA, number 3 is Pennsport, number 15 is Greece Athena, number 19 is Churchville Chilly, and number 22 is Webster Schroeder. And Class A, number 1 is Aquinas, number 13 is Wayne, and number 24 is Pittsford Sutherland. And Class B, number 7 is Livonia, number 9 is Hornell, number 16 is Penyan, and number 19 is Williamson. And Class C, number 2 is Kendall. Number 3 is Byron Bergen, number 5 is Geneseo, number 13 is Keshequa, and in number 18 spot is Bloomfield. And in Class D, number 1 is C.G. Finney, number 4 is Fillmore, number 14 is Avoca Prattsburg, and in number 18 is North Star Christian Academy. Schroeder tops Class AA state volleyball rankings. When Section 5 volleyball tournaments begin, the girls' Class A tournament will be one to watch. Irondequoit Victor and Webster Schroeder have a combined 3 losses so far this season, and those strong starts have been rewarded with strong standing in the latest state rankings from the New York Volleyball Coaches Association. Schroeder remains the top team in Class AA despite suffering a 4-set setback last week against Fairport. With half of the season still left to play, plenty of movement is possible. Here's when those 3 teams match up. On Monday, October 6th, Webster Schroeder is at Irondequoit at 7 p.m. And Tuesday, October 21st, Victor is at Webster Schroeder at 7:30 p.m. The state ranked Section 5 girls volleyball teams, Class AAA, number 3 is Penfield, number 5 is Our Lady of Mercy, honorable mentions is Fairport. Class AA, number 1 is Webster Schroeder, number 5 is Irondequoit, number 6 is Victor, and there are no honorable mentions. Class A, number 1 is Pittsford Sutherland. Honorable mentions include Pittsford Mendon and Eastridge. And Class B, number 9 is C.G. Finney, and number 10, Harley Allendale Columbia, with no honorable mentions. In Class C, number 7 is Leroy, and number 9, Bloomfield, no honorable mentions. And in Class D, number 5 is York, number 7 is Avoca Prattsburg, and number 10 is Fillmore, and honorable mention goes to Elba. State-ranked Section 5 boys volleyball teams in Division 1 is number 1 Fairport, and number 2 is Penfield, and in Division 2, number 1 is Spencerport. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Thursday, October 2nd issue of the Canandaigua Daily Messenger. Your reader has been Lori. Thank you for listening.